This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here with us on WNRN and Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. This is one of those shows that I hope everybody who's listening is taking notes of some sort. Notes with paper, mental notes, stretch out the fingers. You're welcome to call in and give your thoughts and ask your questions to our guest today, Courtney Stewart. Courtney is currently the editor-in-chief at the Seville Weekly. Used to be is lead writer appropriate?
I was senior editor reporter
at the Hook.
At the Hook,
and just a phenomenal number of stories that required lots of research and many stories of, unfortunately, of this type, sort of detective work. Correct.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is an element of detective work as a reporter. I think you have to make it clear in your own mind and to everyone else that you're not actually a detective. You're not a police officer trying to solve the crime faster than the police can. You are reporting for the public to inform people about what's going on in an investigation. If there are opportunities to uncover relevant information that maybe hasn't been discovered yet by police, that does happen. But I see my role as sort of a watchdog and somebody who gets the information out.
And so Courtney's here today to talk with us about Hannah Graham. Unfortunately, a missing young woman. It's now been slightly more than a week since Hannah Graham has gone missing. We'll also be talking about what has become, since it's been pointed out, a disturbing number of other missing folks in our area. We don't know if they are in any way related to Hannah Graham being missing, but certainly the topic has been brought up. And with Courtney Stewart having done some writing on a couple of these other folks, it seems appropriate to me to take advantage of the knowledge in the room. So for those who are not aware, it seems to be a very small percentage at this point. Hannah Graham, 18-year-old white girl, 5 feet, 11 inches tall. She's been described as having a slender build, blue eyes, light brown hair with freckles. A University of Virginia student who went missing early Saturday morning, last Saturday morning. She was last seen wearing a black crop top, and I believe black pants as well. So, Courtney, we'll go through the history of this as we go along throughout the hour, but disappeared at 1-ish a.m. last Saturday. Questions about where she might be nearly 24 hours later, I guess her roommates and family sort of determined that, oh, have you heard from her? Have you heard from her? No. Searching for her since Sunday, and here we are a week later. Most of the major news happening, or the last bits of major news happening Friday. Did anything happen yesterday or early this morning for those who have been following the case?
Well, the police, as far as I know, haven't released anything new this weekend. There were extensive searches happening yesterday, Saturday. Just, I think, 1,000 people or, somewhere in that number, scouring the city, people's neighborhoods being looked at, backyards being searched. Really, I think a sort of a sickening feeling for people. You know, you live in a what you think is a safe city neighborhood, and suddenly there are search teams in your backyard looking for signs of this missing girl.
And as best you know, nothing was found yesterday. And I believe that these search groups are in progress now. I believe they were going to start at 8 a.m. this morning another 2 to 4 hours and do this again.
Right. And I've seen several things posted this weekend about, even if you don't find something, there is still, you've still accomplished clearing an area. You know that there's nothing in that particular neighborhood or that particular segment of woods you've searched. So you're narrowing it down and you can say, well, there's nothing there. So now we can move on to other places. But I haven't heard that they have found anything relevant.
And let's give out the tip line. Again, this has been going on for slightly more than a week, but it still seems pertinent to continue to give out these bits of information. The tip line, if you know of anything, if you saw her, if you need to see pictures of this young woman, I know that you can go to many Facebook pages. I tend to follow Coy Barefoot and Hawes Spencer, two friends and folks who have been on this program. But they are on top of the news.
They are.
These press releases from the police department, from other areas. You can go there. You can see the videos of this young woman. You go to Facebook, and it's Coy Barefoot or Hawes Spencer. I would think, Courtney, do you know the official Charlottesville Police Department or UVA Police Department web address?
Well, you can get to the police department. I don't have the exact URL. I think it's just through charlottesville.org.
But Google it.
Yeah.
Find it. You can see the videos and the pictures of this young woman. Is this someone who's familiar to you, someone that you saw last weekend? The tip line, 434-295-3851. So let's do a little bit of this history, which will continue throughout the hour. Again, Courtney Stewart, editor-in-chief at the Seville Weekly. You can find a lot of the articles that have been put there at c-ville.com. So a young woman disappears last Saturday.
Early Saturday morning. So she had been out on Friday night with friends on the corner, I understand, at Fig Restaurant, departed the company of her friends about 11 or so, then proceeded on by herself to a couple of other locations, house parties, I think, in the corner area. Does not appear to have been with friends as she then left the party, and then was picked up by surveillance video walking along Preston Avenue in front of McGrady's restaurant there, and also in front of the Preston Avenue Shell station. So those videos came out last week, and so she was last on those videos seen headed east towards the downtown mall. And then, of course, there were eyewitness accounts of her there and subsequent release of surveillance videos from Sal's restaurant and Tool Jewelers showed her walking eastbound on the mall in the company at the end of a man and with several other people visible in those videos.
And you can see if you watch the videos and read the comments, you can get a feel for some of the people who are putting comments under these articles that it seems apparent that they made tips, because you can read a comment from one person who said, oh, she stands out because of her height and because she's attractive. So when she walked past us sitting out, every man there turned their head to see her because she was apparently attractive and tall and dressed to catch the attention of these men. And that probably came out completely incorrectly.
Yeah, I was going to say she was dressed in a way that she enjoyed dressing, but it was an eye-catching top, which was, I think, like sort of a gold midriff-bearing shirt. So she was decked out for a night on the town with her friends, but it was something memorable. You know, people would notice. It wasn't just like a black tank top.
Thank you for saving me on that. So she stands out, and people see her, but then as she gets further down the mall, we don't hear much about all these people who were there. So everyone seems to be talking. When you go to the Facebook, when you read the articles under Seville Weekly, there's a lot of presumption. Do you think that that's a problem in this case?
Well, I think it's a problem. You know, it certainly would be a problem if there were presumptions happening by the investigators. And I think as a reporter, I'm trying to avoid any presumption. You know, just take the information that we have and, you know, and try to explore those things. The people that she interacted with, there was one man who appeared to step out from a doorway and begin walking after her. That man, I believe, is the person who gave police the tip that she had then encountered a black man who put his hand around her waist. The initial description that was given by police was that that person had close cropped hair. Of course, for people who've been following the case, we now know that the person they're considering of interest has dreadlocks, longer hair. And so, you know, that's what we know. We know that she or that man ended up at Tempo Restaurant at the end of the mall on Fifth Street. The staff there, as my understanding is, nobody saw her, but he was there briefly. And, you know, that's the information we have at this point. Then we know that they have searched his car, taken his car, impounded it, searched his house, recovered bags of evidence, but we don't know what that evidence is. We don't know that there is anything tying her to his vehicle or his apartment. We just know that there is video evidence that they encountered each other and he has spoken with police. We don't know what he said. And that's, you know, that's where things stand, sort of. Those are the facts. You know, whether you choose to try to put those things into a larger narrative and start assigning intent or things sound nefarious, I don't know. I'm resisting jumping to any conclusions.
How difficult is that?
I think it is difficult because we're all sort of sick over her disappearance. I think human nature is you want to solve this thing. We all want to be armchair detectives and we all want to put this together to bring a conclusion to this case, to catch if there's somebody responsible for her disappearance, to bring that person to justice. If there's a way to bring her home, to do that. And so that's a natural response by everyone. So it is hard to just step back and say, you know, we don't know enough yet to make any assumptions, and we should be open to any possibilities that come up.
We're all storytellers of some sort.
Sure.
And as someone who has written hundreds of articles, maybe thousands, many of which, as I mentioned at the start of the program, have involved crimes. And so that's why I asked that question. How hard is it for you to not look ahead in telling the story, finding the next step for Monday's article and, you know, solving the crime or at least providing another paragraph to the story?
Sure. Well, I think maybe, you know, from years of doing this and covering stories like this, I know that ultimately there will be a complete narrative where we'll, you know, you'll be able to go from the beginning when she disappeared through whatever information they have obtained and then released. And then ultimately, if there is an arrest, you'll have that piece. Right now, all we can do is look at these like little pieces of the story. You know, we had the Preston Avenue piece. You can tell that story based on those facts. Then the downtown mall piece gets added. Then you have the search piece, you know, the search of his apartment and the impounding of his car, that piece. And you can start stringing those things together. But, you know, you have to resist coming to a conclusion before there is one and trying to tell a story that leads people to a conclusion, because we should not be doing that.
Courtney Stewart here on WNRN today, Sunday morning, talking about currently talking about Hannah Graham, the case that has been now going on for about 8 days. The missing young University of Virginia woman. Again, if you're just beginning to follow this case, you can always go to cville.com, c-ville.com, or many other, Google the story. There are many news reports out there for you. The tip line, 434-295-3851. Courtney, how do you believe others are viewing the quality of work done by the Charlottesville Police Department and Chief Tim Longo?
Well, I'm hearing a variety of different things. I mean, I think he has a really hard job, and in a situation like this where you have the heat of the international media and these press conferences where there are rows of cameras and, you know, CNN reporters there, and as people who've been following closely know, the Daily Mail from England has been covering this case. So he's got a lot on his plate in addition to trying to lead the investigation. I have some questions that have not been answered to my satisfaction about various pieces of this case, and I'm not looking for him to reveal delicate information, but just sort of more generally things about the timing of release. I guess maybe we'll talk later about the fact that there have been a couple of other sexual assaults recently, and the fact that as a reporter, I don't feel that we have been given satisfactory information about those things in order to put them into the context of this other narrative to alert the public, to see, even if they're not in any way related to Hannah Graham, to try to make sure that there isn't another predator out there preying on women. I just, you know, so I have some questions that I'm hoping to get answered in coming days.
11:13 here on WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Courtney Stewart, Editor-in-Chief at the Seaville Weekly. Let's do this, and we'll come back and we'll talk about some of those issues that Courtney just mentioned.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
The Southern Cafe and Music Hall, 103 South 1st Street in Charlottesville. The Southern presents Ethan Johns tomorrow, All Them Witches on Wednesday, Andrew Combs and Matthew Perryman Jones on Thursday, and Avers on Friday. For more event listings or tickets, thesouthernseaville.com.
Bricks Wood-Fired Pizza in Barracks Road Shopping Center, serving lunch and dinner with 24 beers on tap and a half pizza, half salad lunch special every day. You can keep up with Bricks special events and tap takeovers on Facebook. Bricks delivers all over Charlottesville. You can place your order at orderup.com.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And back in action here on WNRN, Courtney Stewart with us talking about, currently talking about Hannah Graham and some of the issues involved with that case, some of the facts. So, Courtney, you mentioned, or we both mentioned, the fact that there were some other sexual assaults that were not brought to light until late mid to second half of this current week, even though they took place around the same time of Hannah Graham. So I'm going to read you this paragraph. For listeners out there, please be aware that it's brought together from a couple different people whose news I have faith in, but that doesn't mean that this is all 100% accurate. It's sort of a, Courtney, as an editor, amalgamation, is that a true word?
Sure, let's go with that.
Am I making stuff up?
Yes, no, I think that's good.
I tend to make words up. An aggravated assault called into Charlottesville police at 1:40 a.m. on early Saturday morning, September 13th, same time frame that Hannah went missing, believed to be a young man who was beaten so badly he has required facial reconstructive surgery. This was on the this was on 13th Street near UVA Corner and within a few blocks from the other from two other sexual assaults the UVA police said took place that last weekend in Charlottesville. In the early morning hours of September 14th, a female UVA student reported being sexually assaulted near Wortland Street in Charlottesville. And then less than 24 hours later, police found an unconscious female with injuries in the 200 block of 15th Street Northwest. For those listening not familiar with the Charlottesville area, this is all within a very small circle of where Hannah was going for the party. According to a statement from the University of Virginia Police Chief Michael Gibson, that woman, the woman who was left unconscious, is a local resident, and police are investigating the situation as a possible sexual assault. So there are three different assaults listed here, all in the same weekend.
A horrifying weekend of violence, excluding Hannah Graham's disappearance.
Right. And so talk about how this information, now Hannah Graham is listed as missing on Sunday, which would have been the 14th. Mm-hmm. And so, and then there are three other people who were found and had some reported assault of some type, and yet these other three are not released to the community as possible connective issues.
Right. Connected or otherwise, even if Hannah Graham hadn't disappeared that weekend, I think that there could have been a much, let's say, a much stronger effort made to get that information out to the public, not only to university students who should be aware that these things are happening in the place where they live and walk, you know, by themselves or even in small groups. But to the rest of the town, I mean, the university and non-university Charlottesville residents overlap. We are all at risk if these things are happening in our town, and we need to know. At the press conference on, I think it was Friday, that question was posed to Chief Longo, who responded passionately, let's say. He was sort of angry, it seemed, at the questioning, and he held up a piece of paper, and it was a printout of an email that goes out every morning to reporters all over town, including myself. And that is, it's an arrest record. So it's an incident report. So you get a list every morning of the incidents that have happened in previous days. And he was saying, we did put this information out. And indeed, on a report that came out, I don't know if it was Monday, there was just a single line entry or two lines that said reported forcible rape, didn't give a location, doesn't give any other information. And when I sought information this week after Hannah Graham's disappearance, I haven't gotten the kind of response that I would have wanted. I'd like to have that conversation about what prompts a press release. Do you only send out a press release when people have already started asking about it? Shouldn't there be some aggressive effort made to alert the public when these things happen, not to be a scaremonger, but to inform and to make sure that people know these things are happening, to try to solve these crimes quickly? If the public doesn't know that something's happened, if there's no description of a potential assailant, how do you get tips? How does anything get solved?
Courtney Stewart here. She's the editor-in-chief at the Seville Weekly. It seems like now's a good time to open up the phone line if you have a question. Please keep them appropriate, questions and comments. Please keep them appropriate. 434-979-0919. Again, we are talking currently about Hannah Graham. The tip line, if you need it, 434-295-3851, just to make you confused as possible with many phone numbers. Call in line 434-979-0919. Courtney, whether I ask this question to you personally and then for any sort of group information and emotions that you may be having at work or involved in this case, we talk about those other assaults. Do we need some sort of, for lack of a better phrase, amber alert for when these things happen and what appeared to be a group setting? They're all within, I mean, this is within, I don't even know if it can be smaller than four blocks of one another. For the three cases that of the individuals whose incidents we know what happened, and then, of course, we have Hannah Graham who's missing. Do you think we need a sort of amber alert where the information is sent via email or phone call to the university students and then to the city at large?
I think that there should be some. I think the university does have some kind of alert system that's supposed to be in place, and that was triggered on Thursday night with a letter from Police Chief Mike Gibson. Yeah, so that was like at 11:30, I think, on Thursday night, saying that they had just been informed about these other assaults, and that went to the university community. That eventually made it to me. I'm not part of the university community, so I'm not on the I'm not on that list. I could probably ask, to be added, and I do get them quickly. But yeah, I think that there should be something in place, an Amber Alert. That's a fairly excessive measure that makes everybody's cell phones light up. But yeah, there should be a quick and formal method for getting information out in a timely way. And again, it's not that every single crime needs to trigger a full-length press release, but when you have things like this that seem, it's a cluster, they are particularly violent, they are horrific, they are, doesn't appear there is a known suspect in these cases at this point, or I'm not aware of one. So yeah, I do think that should happen.
Well, and we talk about that everyone in that area is not a university student. When you have all the restaurants and shops on the corner, you have a fair number of people who otherwise are not involved with the university other than coming to work to retail to university students and staff. And they would not have received that email from the university about that you mentioned on Thursday about the violent crimes that went out.
Correct. Right. So the university community gets it. The rest of us don't. I think that's a problem.
Again, Courtney Stewart here in the studio, 1123, talking about Hannah Graham. What do you think about the University of Virginia and their responsibility to the students? So we talk about whether or not they send out an email, which, for lack of a better phrase, I've called an Amber Alert, to alert the students and staff that this grouping of incidents and violent incidents that you mentioned has taken place. Should they provide more late-night services to help the students get home after possibly drinking too much, or even just studying or working at the library, but then having to work their way home in early evening hours?
Well, I think they do offer some services. I think there, you know, there's like a phone system around. I think that there is a ride. I think you can call a cab and charge it to your student account if you don't have money with you. They do have some things in place. They've done this initiative, Who's Got Your Back, this year, where they're trying to increase the sort of peer protection where people are looking out for each other. I don't think it's realistic for the university, without becoming like a totalitarian state, to try to control the whereabouts or the behavior completely of their adult students. I mean, these are young adults, but they're, you know, for the vast majority, unless it's some savant, they're all over 18 by the you know, within a couple of weeks of arriving their first year. So you have adults. Certainly the university has a responsibility to inform, to provide services, to do whatever they can to educate and keep students safe. But again, these are not children. These are adults, and they do have a right to walk around the city if they choose to, in whatever manner they choose to do.
But drinking at age 18 is not legal.
No, it's not. And
again, not to blame the victim. That's not the point of this part of the conversation.
Well, it should never be the point of any conversation, I would say. But right, I don't think the university promotes underage drinking. I don't, you know, I guess there's another conversation about whether the drinking age should be 21 in the first place. I think the idea that we're ever, ever, ever going to get 18-year-olds to never drink until they're 21 is ludicrous. I think responsible drinking should be the goal. I just, that's my personal opinion, and I think it's a losing battle to think that you can have sort of teetotalers as undergrads until their 21st birthday.
Well, we have the University of Virginia and has an honor code. Next week, actually, I'll have two guests on to talk about the university's honor code and its history up until some recent attempts at modernizing it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe, or have you heard discussion about involving the honor code in drinking, or even that they have a judiciary system as well? And if you're caught drinking under the age of 21,
I don't think they would have any students left. Well, but, I mean, yeah, I suppose you
would. Could you have safer students for the ones that you have?
Your student body of three would do very well. I mean, that's, you know, okay, that's sort of maybe that's not the right attitude to take. I think, yeah, you know, I think it is against the law. I think that having a fake ID and going and breaking the law and being out in bars and doing that is against the law. That is a legal issue. And if they're caught doing it, they should, you know, they're going to face legal sanctions. I think that efforts need to be made in a way that has a chance of being successful. And I think that the college drinking is an entrenched pastime. And I cannot see a world in which college students don't drink at all. I would like to see a world in which, you know, that would be great, or maybe it wouldn't. I think the being responsible and I think that's where I would want to focus my efforts, is making sure that you are not putting yourself in at risk, making sure that your education efforts are aimed not at women to avoid crime, but at men to avoid committing crimes. I mean, that's where the effort should be going, in my opinion.
Here. 1127 on the Wake Up Call. Courtney Stewart here, editor-in-chief at the Civo Weekly, as we continue to talk about Hannah Graham and the incident of her being not found. We don't know where she is, now been gone for 8 days. Comments or questions for Courtney Stewart, 434-979 1919. Courtney, we talked about some of the most recent information on Friday. The Charlottesville Police Department getting a warrant to check through a person of interest's car and apartment. The gentleman's right. name not being released to
police,
the press.
Police are not releasing the name. His name has been released by the press. I don't think at this point that I or Seville will be using it in stories. The Washington Post has made that decision as well because he is not a formal suspect. He is a person of interest. I mean, Chief Longo didn't even want to describe him that. He said, we're interested in him or something along those lines. And so at this point, this is a guy who appears in a surveillance video, who had some interaction. He's not the only person who had interaction. He's captured, you know, in that frame from Tool Jewelers with her. So I think it's safe to say that they did interact. But as far as what happened after that, and as far as whether she did get in his car or whether he did something, we don't know. And police haven't given us enough information to make that assumption at all.
But so let's talk about for a minute. Let me ask you this question about the whether that's a good. How do you make that decision for Seville Weekly to not publish the name, because his name has come out through the publication of other journalists? So how do you make that decision? How does Washington Post make that decision now that his name is out there?
Right. Well, and it's an ongoing decision. It's like, as of right now, we haven't used his name. As of today, I don't intend to publish a story today with his name in it. I think you have to have some kind of policy, some ethical guideline that you use. When somebody is named as a person of interest, when you put them in the paper, you know, they are then connected forever to that story. And you don't know at that point whether they should be. I mean, the implication of this is terrible. The implication is that, you know, what they have released, I think reasonable people can come to the conclusion that police believe he has done something to her. And I think that it's, even though people can find his name elsewhere, I think it's important to stick to ethical guidelines and decide when and how you want to proceed in cases like this.
At Seville Weekly, is this your decision as the editor-in-chief? Is this a group decision where the other journalists covering this article sit down and you talk about it as a group?
Well, ultimately, I mean, in this particular situation, I've had a brief conversation with the news editor, Graylin Brashear, and so she and I, that was the direction we were leaning, because it doesn't necessarily add to the story. Beyond what we know or what has been released, the car searching his apartment, adding his name without any other evidence, he hasn't been arrested, he hasn't been charged, there's nothing. I don't know that is a piece of the story that needs to be there at this point. The police are saying we don't have enough to arrest him. So, you know, yeah, I would love as a reporter to speak with him. I'd like to speak with his family as some other reporters have done, hear what he has to say, get his side of things. If he said, yeah, I want to come out with my name and my photo and I am innocent and I don't appreciate this attention, then absolutely. But naming him against his will or stalking him, you know, paparazzi stalking him, is not something that I'm going to do today.
Again, 11:32 here on the Wake Up Call. Courtney Stewart, she's the editor-in-chief at the Seville Weekly, talking about Hannah Graham. And we're also talking about, or we're about to start talking about, the fact that there are a disturbing number of people who have been missing over the last several years, all within this area, depending on how large you want to make the area, from Culpeper down to Charlottesville, down to Lovingston. Courtney, and I know that you have covered some of these cases. I don't know that you've covered all of them. Is this, you know, how do you filter this through your journalist's head? Do you write an article about, oh, hey, you know, look at all this. Wow, this is scary. Who prompts that sort of thinking?
Well, I think you start, you know, cases like this, you always, as you're also trying to think about tangential issues or ways that this could tie into a bigger picture story, of course. And I think everybody must have consider the similarities between this and some of these other local cases. Certainly Morgan Harrington immediately comes to mind. In both cases, you have a young woman alone, late at night, in the dark, on public streets in the city. The mysterious and seemingly sudden vanishing with very little sign. I mean, we didn't have any surveillance video in the Morgan Harrington case. Here, at least, we do have some from the mall, but after that 106 or whatever time that, you know, after that one time-stamped video, there is no sign of her. So those things are similar, and I think it's natural to wonder if they're connected. Again, I think there is nowhere near enough information at this time to start doing anything but saying, hey, that's, you know, those are some similarities. You have Deshaud Smith, another young person who vanished mysteriously. I think in that case, it didn't get nearly the attention. I mean, it did get some press attention, but that's a case that I think happened here in the city of Charlottesville. There are other cases where we know there's no connection. We know that there's no apparent connection. I mean, we have Alexis Murphy out in Nelson, but Randy Taylor, who's been convicted of her death, even without her body being found, is in jail. So he didn't have anything to do with the disappearance of Hannah Graham.
Again, I find this to be, it just sort of makes your stomach roll uncomfortably when you start 11:34 here on the Wake Up Call.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
Music Today. Based in Crozet, Music Today powers ticketing for local venues such as the Intellos Wireless Pavilion, the Southern Cafe and Music Hall, and the Jefferson Theater, and is official web stores for hundreds of artists, athletes, and entertainers. That's Music Today.
McGrady's Irish Pub on Grady Avenue, a veteran-owned sports pub under new ownership and management. McGrady's new menu holds a variety of loaded baked potatoes and Blarney Stone steaks. McGrady supports local charities, hosts trivia on Tuesdays and ladies' night on Wednesdays, and is dedicated to getting everyone a safe ride home. McGrady'sIrishPub.com.
Hi, I'm Jamie Cato, Admissions Director for Oakland School. Oakland, a short drive from Charlottesville, offers an individualized program for students in grades 1st through 8th. We offer small class size, daily one-to-ones, and specific skills instruction that focuses on reading, math, written language, organization, and study skills. This curriculum is built for students seeking support. We invite you to Oakland School's open house on Monday, October 13th at 10 a.m. This is your opportunity to meet Carol Williams, our head of school, take a tour of the campus and classrooms, and learn more about Oakland's year-round and summer programs. For more information, oaklandschool.net. I'm Jamie Cato, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And back in action here on WNRN, our guest today, Courtney Stewart. She's the editor-in-chief at the Seaville Weekly as we discuss Hannah Graham and several of the other missing folks over the last several years. Courtney, during the break, you and I were talking about cameras on the downtown mall. Any feedback or thoughts from folks that you work with or folks that you have had discussions with during this article, during this time frame, about cameras on the downtown mall? Because there was a discussion however many years ago about the city putting up cameras on the mall. And, of course, there was the, yes, we need these versus the, no, you're getting into my privacy issue.
Sure. Well, yeah, and Chief Longo has been very outspoken in his wish for these cameras for years, and actually voiced a lot of frustration at the first press conference I attended with this Hannah Graham case that hadn't happened, and that if we'd had them, maybe there'd be more videoed evidence, clearer pictures of what had happened, what had transpired as she walked down the mall. I hear both sides, but frankly, in the last week, I have been hearing more people in support of the cameras and sort of a sense that sure, there's the argument about a right to privacy in this surveillance state and the fears of sort of Big Brother watching all the time. But then on the flip side, and this is the argument I hear a lot of people making, is there really any expectation of any privacy at all as you walk in a public space like the downtown mall? We are all walking around with handheld surveillance cameras in the form of iPhones or Androids or whatever, you know, whatever we have. We have this technology at our fingertips. And if you are doing anything on the downtown mall, there is an expectation that the public is going to see you, that somebody could snap a picture of you with their iPhone and post it to Twitter. So what is this expectation of privacy that we are so afraid of losing with the installation of surveillance cameras by the police force? And I think there are arguments against it, certainly because it is the government. It's not an individual. It's something that gets into their hands that they can then use. And so there's a fear of sort of that creep, which we hear in every area of our lives, from, you know, the NSA stuff and just the fact that we're being watched. I think that's much creepier. I would rather be videotaped on the downtown mall than have somebody tracking my keystrokes.
You know, I'll phrase it as an important or enlightening article done by the London Daily Mail on the Hanegram issue. And if you read the comments, because it's done by a British newspaper, many of the people reading the article apparently are from London or are British. And several of the comments say, oh, once they get the CCTV video, they'll be able to fill in all the information. Because London, I believe London is often noticed as the city with the greatest number of video cameras. You pretty much can't go from here to there without being tracked fully with almost every step. And for those folks, or at least those who made the comments, it was like, this will be easy to solve this crime, because you want to know who got her and took her away? Look on the cameras.
Right. And of course, they don't exist here. We have private businesses that have whatever security system they could afford at the time that they installed it. So they're probably not the most up-to-date technologies, and they're not aimed at the public space. They are used to protect that business's interests. So in the case of the videos that we got on the mall, they weren't trying to videotape people passing by. They were trying to videotape somebody trying to break in their front door, and they happened to capture what was past the front door. In the case of a mall assault back in late December, the issue of the cameras came up again, where there was a couple on the mall, of course, said that they had been attacked randomly. That turned into a big kind of ugly story over the next month. And there was no video from the Wachovia Bank, although they immediately assumed that there would have been, because the camera at the bank was aimed at the ATM machine, not at the bricks. So they were saying, look at the, you know, get the bank video and you'll see what we're saying. And of course, there was no video because the bank was only worried about their ATM machine, understandably.
What do you think, I ask this of you as a person, I don't know that you can answer this as the editor-in-chief at Seville Weekly, but insurance companies, it seems to me that safety should be a community issue.
Sure.
Whether we're talking about an 18-year-old woman who is what many people say is intoxicated. I don't know, you know, how we prove that other than just description from her friends and whoever saw her when she left the party. Or whether you're talking about me, not an 18-year-old woman. But safety seems to be a community issue. Should insurance companies help this by businesses that put their cameras out so that you can be more of the London CCTV setup, so that the government isn't paying for this, but the private industry is?
So you mean insurance companies would give some sort of discount to companies that post, that have
for all those surveillance? For many of those other companies along the downtown mall, along the corner, places that might have a greater community need for this.
But why would the insurance company give any sort of discount for that? That's sort of an altruistic That's an altruistic motive,
yeah,
and they have only a cost-saving motive. So to me, yes, I think they do give discounts to companies. I bet. I mean, I don't know because I don't own a business, but I suspect, I know as a homeowner, I got a discount on my home insurance rate because I have a security system and a wired smoke detector. So I got rewarded with a few dollars off a month on my my home insurance because I had taken these steps that I guess by their estimates reduce my risk at property loss. So maybe they do the same thing with businesses that install these cameras in terms of giving a discount, but it's not because they're worried about the girl that walked in front of the store. It's because they're worried about having to replace the plate glass window.
I'm curious as to what somebody else might think about how does the community do this so it's not the government to support video cameras, whether you believe for it or not. Again, 434-979-0919. 1144 here on the Wake Up Call. Courtney Stewart with us today. She's editor-in-chief at the Seville Weekly. You can keep up to date on these articles. It's c-ville.com. Courtney, Carey called in from Charlottesville. He commented, why can't they check her text messages to see where she was going? And I think both of us know the answer, but not everybody does.
Well, the answer is they can and they have, and there has been some information about that, but very little specifics released. But certainly, I know from other cases that there is a high-tech police investigative team right now pouring over cell phone data, not just from her cell phone, but now from his, using towers most likely to try to locate where she was when they were sent. If her phone continued to ping, even though she wasn't using it, that will provide information. When did her phone actually last make final contact with a tower? That would be a piece of information they'll be looking at. I've seen a couple of different things. I thought, and I want to go back and double check this, my understanding is that her last sent message was at 1:20 when she said she was lost in the area of Wortland and 14th Street. I know that that was said at some point last week. They then kind of backtracked on that. The police backtracked and said they thought that text was mistaken. I'm not clear on what that was. I then read a Washington Post report from Friday that said her last text message was sent at 1:06. So that's different, and I don't know what's accurate at this point. That's on my list of facts to check to really try to get clearer on the use of her phone and the messages she was sending.
So it's also was reported, and you know, I want to know what you know, that her phone was either turned off or lost all power.
Sure. Yes.
Is that true? And so at some point around that time, there were no more pings.
I think so. I think that is my understanding of it, that it got turned off or it died. I don't know. I don't know what type of phone she had or whether there was a way to know what her battery level was, if the cell, you know, if there was alerts. My phone, you know, lights up when I have 10% back, 20%, and then 10%, battery. I don't know if that sort of thing would be available to them in any way. And, you know, I guess the final cell phone tower ping, since she was somewhere downtown, it may not even be that helpful because cell phones kind of pick towers on a variety of factors, some of which is, you know, if there's a building in the way, or some of which is if there's a lot of traffic on one tower, it'll go to another. So I just...
Let me ask you a few questions that I've seen little bits, or the well-known piece of information receiving many comments about, well, why didn't they do this? So she's seen running the video camera at the Shell station on Preston Street, which is east of, it's between the university and the downtown mall heading east. She's seen running.
Right. She's seen running sort of downhill on the south side of Preston Avenue, headed east towards the mall. She's running, but then while she's still in the frame, she stops and she begins walking again. So there's been speculation that maybe there were some people under the train bridge there that made her uneasy, so she ran past because she was uneasy. I think that does, you know, she looked unsteady on her feet in the video. That's just my personal assessment, based on sort of how she went off a curb and sort of her gait. But by the time she was a little further down the street, she was capable of running. She's been described as an athlete, and you know, didn't appear she was being chased, and then it appeared that whatever caused her to run stopped. Maybe she was just trying to get somewhere faster. She was out at 1 a.m. by herself. There must have been a piece of, you know, part of her that was aware that that probably not the, you know, the greatest situation to find yourself in.
She's also seen on the video outside of McGrady's.
Yeah.
And she seems to be walking around but never enters, and has the bouncer been interviewed?
I know that police said that they were hoping to be interviewing him. That was earlier this week, and I don't know that they did. She did not get into that restaurant. It's not even clear from the video that she tried. She did walk sort of a circle around their outdoor patio, coming up in between the patio and the restaurant itself before going back down to the sidewalk and then continuing on east on Preston.
Courtney Stewart, editor-in-chief at the Seville Weekly, c-ville.com. Go on and keep up to date on the articles involving Hannah Graham. We talk about who has seen her on the downtown mall. There's many people. You can go on and you can see these videos. They're difficult, but at this point, many of them have little circles around them highlighting her so you can see where she is in the video. There's one of them where a gentleman is in front of her and then stops and then pulls up behind her. And there's been a question about his actions and behavior.
Well, he's sort of now been described as a kind of a good Samaritan, somebody who saw her, was concerned about her well-being, stepped out, started following her, and then backed off because she encountered this other man he described, and he felt like they knew each other. And so that, you know, you can't see any of that happening on the video. He went voluntarily, I think, and spoke with police. So I don't know the status of, you know, of his involvement, or whether they're still interested or looking at anything with him, or, you know, whether they have other information. You also assume in a case like this that they don't release everything to the public. They hold some stuff back because it's an investigation, and, you know, it's not an investigation by the whole town. It's an investigation by the police.
Question from Shad asks, what are the number of Charlottesville police that are patrolling the downtown mall?
That's a question I would like to know, too. I know that they had upped the numbers, and there should be a significant police presence on a weekend night on the downtown mall, foot patrol, bike cops. Somebody asked to check whether on any of those videos from the mall there was ever a police, you know, presence picked up. You know, did we see a cop walk by on foot? Did we see a bike cop at any point, you know, within an hour of her appearance on that video? And I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know that I'll even be able to get the answer, because that video has been taken in by police, and they've released what they have determined to be the pertinent segment. So I don't know the answer, and I do intend to find out specifically the number of police officers and the approach to policing the downtown mall at that time.
No, there's still only one police officer that patrols the corner on a regular basis, correct?
I think that's right, but again, you know, I don't know the beats that they're assigned exactly, or the number of people at any given time of a day on a Friday night, for instance, on the corner. Do they assign an extra person? I don't know.
Courtney Stewart here as we're talking about Hannah Graham. 434-979-0919. If you have a question for Courtney, call us up. So, Courtney, we know that the warrants were put forth for the gentleman, and his car was impounded, and the police went into his apartment as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that you know, at this point, no one knows what was in there.
They're sealed, right? And so normally when you do this, when there's a search warrant, these things are filed in the courthouse, and then you can go and see what was taken out. You don't know what the result of forensic testing is, but you could, you know, in some cases you can go and see, oh, they took out four laptops, a cell phone, and a, you know, the blender from the kitchen or something, you know, whatever it is that they've taken. But in this case, those things are sealed, and so that could change, but we don't know at this point.
But for many people, it's, oh, if they find her DNA in the car, or if they don't find her DNA in the car, that leads to this decision by the police. How do they, if would they have her DNA?
I think, yeah, I mean, I think that when you do a thorough forensic examination of a car,
but how would would they have her DNA from something else? I mean, they may find a hair strand, but in what other event would they have her DNA before they went to his car?
Well,
just from a general visit to the doctor?
Well, sure. I mean, that, you know, in every case where you're having to use DNA, you go, you take her toothbrush, you take her hairbrush, you know, take clothes that she's worn. You know, we leave trails of our DNA everywhere we go. In fact, touching smooth surfaces leaves hints of DNA. You have to probably be sure that it's not all mixed up with other stuff. But there's any number of ways to have gotten a DNA sample. You could also take DNA from a family member and do familial match. So having a sample of her DNA to compare against other things, I don't think would have been their greatest challenge. I think they certainly have that, and they are running that right now. I would assume also that they would be running DNA tests on him, running that through the system to see whether that matches to anything, even if there is no criminal history. So all that stuff is undoubtedly going on now at some lab in Richmond.
Do you know how long that takes to run DNA tests?
I don't know exactly how long. I don't think the actual tests take that long. I think the problem is generally that there's a huge backup. So a test that might take, I don't know, an hour, a couple of hours or a day can take 6 months because you have that many cases that have come before. In something like this, where you have an urgent need to get information in a breaking case like this, where there is still hope of getting her back, and time is of the essence, I suspect that this gets to jump ahead of some of the older, colder cases that that are in front of it.
Again, Courtney Stewart here, 11:55 on the wake-up call. We are talking about Hannah Graham. Hannah Graham, 18-year-old young white woman, 5 feet, 11 inches tall. She's described as having a slender build with blue eyes, light brown hair, and freckles. She's a University of Virginia student missing since early last Saturday, 1 a.m. on Saturday the 13th.
Yes.
She's last seen wearing black pants with a black crop top.
It was a gold crop
gold
top. Yeah,
crop top. I can see where the phones come through a couple times. We'll give Melissa a chance to bring something in. So we'll do this. And here's a great question. Anne from Madison, if in any way is mentioning her outfit blaming the victim, the fact that I say and others say she was wearing a black crop top, is that descriptive or is that in any way slamming Hannah?
The only reason, in my opinion, that her outfit is important is because it may help jog somebody's memory. Other than that, in my mind, her outfit has absolutely no bearing on this story or anything that may have happened to her. So that is, I think it is a piece of information that may jog someone's memory and give them the chance to remember something that could be helpful to the case. Other than that, there's no need to talk about what she was wearing.
Call, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Your question, we just got a little bit of time left.
Yeah, that was perfect. That was exactly the distinction that I wanted to make, and it just sounded like the conversation earlier in the show was a little bit different. So absolutely, a factual description is perfect, but any kind of characterizing of it is damaging. So thank you so much for clarifying that.
Sure.
Right, thank you.
Okay.
So, Courtney, what are the questions, or give us a couple of the questions that you have that have not been answered and that you think should be answered? You mentioned a minute or two ago about how the police are running an ongoing case. They're not going to release all the information because they are the detectives, not the community. But there must be a couple of questions that you have that you don't understand why they haven't been answered yet.
We've covered a couple of them earlier in the hour. I have questions about the time in between her last contact with anyone and the fact that she wasn't reported missing until Sunday. And that's not because I want to judge friends or family or anybody for not noticing, but just sort of, I think trying to understand is where did they think she was? You know, what could have been the explanation for that? Could that shed any light on what could have happened? For instance, you know, did she sometimes go and spend the night with a friend somewhere else? Or, you know, did she, was this sort of typical to not show up at home? Could that give any clues about where else she might have gone? So that sort of thing. Certainly, as I've mentioned before, I really feel like we need to have more information about these other assaults that happened that weekend. As far as just a description of the incident, any information about the possible assailant, whether these things are connected or not is irrelevant, actually. I just think the information needs to come out so we can just see what was going on there. And then I think probably the questions I have, I hope, are the ones that are just really obvious that the police are following. I mean, more eyewitness accounts, more information about anybody that may have seen this person of interest with her or without her later in the evening. You know, those sorts of things. But I'm waiting, you know, to see what information comes out early this week, particularly if they can give some information about what sort of evidence they took and whether testing has provided any link.
Is there a planned press time for Chief Longo on Monday?
Not that I'm aware of, no. And usually, I mean, they'll have to do regular updates because the intensity of the interest is such that we have, you know, out-of-town media camped in various places, and so they do need to do sort of regular addresses. The police need to address media and the public in that way regularly. I expect there will be something else on Monday just to sum up the weekend searches, but I don't know that. They may wait until there is something to add to the information that we have.
Courtney, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Rick.
I know that you've spent a lot of time this week, a lot more maybe than regular, focusing on this case and having some of your own personal time here. Greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
C-Ville.com to keep up with the articles. Let's hope that this next weekend we can tell everybody that all ended well.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong
and Max Cecilia Struther.
Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.